Mormon Mental Health Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations are tax deductible and go directly to the costs associated with podcast production. Donations may also go towards research, material development, and counseling costs for those who can't afford them. The goals of this podcast include education, advocacy, and the promotion of health and general well-being for Mormons and their families. To support the podcast and its efforts, please consider a donation today at mormonmentalhealth.org. Thank you for listening. Hello and welcome to Mormon Mental Health. This is Natasha Helfer Parker, and tonight I am happy to welcome two guests to this episode, Holly Welker and Daniel Lancaster. And we're going to be talking about missionary trauma, which is kind of an interesting topic. And I recently did an interview with the two founders of a website called SickRMs, and they did a fabulous job of kind of highlighting some of the issues that sometimes missionaries face while they're out on missions, especially related to health concerns. And I wanted to kind of take that topic a little deeper and therefore invited both of these in a sense, panelists to the program tonight. Now, Holly Welker served a mission in Taiwan in the 1980s. While she was there, she got her first prescription for antidepressants from what she describes a trio of Freudian atheist psychiatrists who spoke to her Chinese while she answered in English. So that's interesting. Maybe we'll hear more about that. She has a PhD in English literature from the University of Iowa and has written about being a missionary for Sunstone, Dialogue, Religion Dispatches, and the New York Times. Her work has also appeared in such venues as Beast American Essays, Slate, and Bitch. She has edited a collection of essays about marriage by Mormon women, currently titled Bearing Witness, 36 Mormon Women Talk Candidly About Love, Sex, and Marriage, and that will be forthcoming in 2016 from the University of Illinois Press. Now, Daniel Lancaster is a psychotherapist in northern Utah, and his clinical practice focuses on people with comorbid medical and mental health conditions, as well as compassion fatigue among human service workers. Additionally, Daniel seeks to raise awareness of and treats mission-related trauma, and he is currently engaged in a postgraduate study of existential analysis and recently self-published a book about his missionary service in Jamaica, a book that he hopes will help open a more honest dialogue within LDS culture regarding the real risks and benefits of missionary service. So with that, welcome to the show, both of you.
Thank you.
Hi. Thank you.
So glad to have you. So I think we'll just start with either one of you can start with maybe giving just a further introduction about yourselves, how you come to be Mormon. Both of you obviously had missionary experiences yourself. I think Holly's going to be speaking to this probably from a more personal perspective, and Daniel may move more from professional, but I think it'll interweave. So definitely give us a chance to get to know you a little bit better and where you come from and why this topic is of interest to you.
Okay. Well, so Holly, am I good to, I guess, just get rolling?
Go for it.
Okay, yeah. Cool. Well, you know, I, as far as kind of your first question about, you know, how I'm connected to Mormonism or what brought us in, I'm sort of a outside insider. You know, I grew up, my whole life has been here in, along the Wasatch Front. But I grew up in a completely inactive LDS family. That said, you know, we're surrounded by the culture, so, a lot of the cultural norms still rub off. I was still baptized when I was 8, even though I'd been to church less than a handful of times, and then immediately moved, you know, to another city. So my relationship with the church in my youth was really mostly non-existent, until I was about 16 years old, at which point, because I was just a big nerdy kid who asked a lot of questions that I don't think I completely understood myself, started thinking about, you know, God and the purpose of being here and all that, and, made some really good friendships, with some people, one girl in particular who was very spiritually connected to her faith, as a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And, through that friendship, I really decided to come into full faith and fellowship of the church, so to speak. I started going to church every week and became, honestly, as Peter Priesthood as somebody can become. I was 1,000% the Mormon male, and I was really excited almost from day one of my activation to serve a mission. I look forward to it. That's all I thought about. I had literally no post high school plans apart from serving a mission and one day becoming a psychotherapist because I was a weird kid. And at about the age 14, I decided I wanted to be a psychotherapist, and that stuck. But anyway, I go over that because my relationship with the church is a little bit different. You know, I followed my own spiritual experience into the church, and that's what kept me attached. There weren't really expectations or family norms. And so, you know, for a long time, and, you know, my relationship with the church was there because it was meaningful, not because it was expected.
Okay, yeah. That's great. And then could you just add a little bit then about how you came to be interested in missionary trauma, and then I'll turn the time over to Holly.
Yeah. So got my mission call to Jamaica. I was really excited and a little confused. I was a little hopeful for Japan, truth be told, because I still am in love with Japan and all things Japanese, even though I've never been there in my life. But I went to Jamaica, and in a word, the experience was brutal. And this is coming from somebody who, again, I was as Peter Priesthood and straightforward as it gets. I was so excited to serve when I got there. And it was hard on several levels that I'm sure we'll delve into here in the next little bit. But I survived. I pulled through, you know, basically the full 2 years, and I came home and was still just, still Peter Priesthood, but with a lot of anger and a lot of, self-doubt and frustrations. And honestly, my interest in mission-related trauma is something that kind of evolved as I continued through my education and professional experience in psychotherapy, while reflecting back on my missionary experience and realizing just how impactful and difficult it was. And then all of a sudden I start talking about these hard conversations and kind of challenging this best 2 years, mythology that we have. And suddenly, to my surprise, almost everybody that I talked to very informally was sharing these same opinions and experiences. And I thought, wow, this is something that it seems like almost everybody's experienced, but nobody really wants to talk about because we're all very concerned to keep selling, you know, the wholesome, wonderful, elated 2 years to the next generation of missionaries. And I decided maybe if we addressed this more forwardly, we could probably have more effective missionaries, but we would definitely also have members of the church who came home less damaged by their mission.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah,
all right, Holly.
Well, I was born. I'm solid pioneer stock. I have ancestors who joined the church in the 1830s. An ancestor who survived the Hans Mill massacre, first wagon train across the plains with Brigham Young, all that stuff. I grew up in a town called Thatcher, Arizona, and I was in college while President Kimball was president. He used to give conference talks about his hometown, which was my hometown. So when I was backpacking across Europe, I would run into Mormons and they would ask where I was from, and I would say, I'm from Thatcher, and they would say, oh, President Kimball's hometown. It was a town so Mormon that we had our high school prom in the cultural hall.
Love that, Holly. Real quick, that's hilarious.
It actually is pretty hilarious. It was very Mormon. And so my entire identity was tied up with Mormonness and with a sense of place. I mean, my favorite hymn is still Firm as the Mountains Around Us. It was just so solidly a part of who I was. And I wasn't a Molly Mormon necessarily because I was too dour and cranky. But I sure liked a lot of Molly Mormon things. I loved textiles. In fact, I'm actually knitting right now. And the essay, I do not have an essay in Beast American Essays. It's actually Best American Essays, but it's about my love of textiles. It's called Satin Worship. And it's very much about how I learned to sew and knit and all those things in primary.
Awesome. For correcting that, by the way. Thank you.
No worries. Yeah. And then as for how I came to be interested in missionary trauma, well, I don't always win the Whose Mission Sucked Worst contest, but I usually place. And I never did the narrative of it was the best 18 months of my life. Even at the time, I told one of my mission presidents that I told both my mission presidents, actually, that I hated my mission. I came home, and in my homecoming talk, I said my mission had been the most painful experience of my life. That's just sort of... It was really hard, and I never said otherwise.
And how was that received by those who were listening to you say that?
Different ways at different times. Sometimes people, well, both my mission presidents told me repeatedly that they appreciated my candor and called me refreshing. They said it was nice to hear someone be honest. A lot of people said things like that, but that didn't mean that they could still necessarily hear what I was trying to tell them about what the experience had meant. A lot of it just didn't compute for people.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you both for that, for that further introduction. And I think, you know, what I want to say next, just to kind of set up the stage here a little bit, is that this podcast is not meant to downplay or minimize the many positive experiences and spiritual accounts that we have from many, many members of the church. And so this is not about putting down missions. This is, I think what this is about is that we have plenty of space in church dialogue for those positive accounts. And therefore tonight is just not going to be one of those spaces. Tonight is going to be a space where we talk about, some of the negative experiences that many people also experience and that are not as openly dialogued in our church culture. And I think that's an important aspect of this. So if this seems negative, well, it is, but it's not in a sense trying to, you know, negate the many positive experiences. I know even in my own family, I have siblings who serve missions, some of them reporting very positive experiences and some very negative. So even within, you know, own family systems, there's obviously a variety of experiences, and that has a lot to do with personality, the person going out, the mission where you're going, the types of leaders and companions you have. I mean, there's multifaceted reasons why there's obviously a variety of experiences out there. Yeah. Okay. So I just want to set it up with that. But we are here to talk about kind of the things that we don't normally talk about or that seem taboo in our culture, which I think negative missionary experiences kind of goes against that whole missionary spirit of everything's positive, everything's wonderful, you know, we're sharing the gospel, what can be wrong about that, right? So that I think is very much a part of our culture and why it's difficult to talk about this. Where I'd like to start is kind of getting your perspectives on pre-mission issues. And I guess what I mean by that is, you know, let's give a little bit of some of the issues that come up as members decide to go on missions and what that process is like. And maybe the familial and cultural expectations that play a role, and you know, expectations maybe that a person might have of going on a mission, et cetera, et cetera. So, Can I give you guys some time to talk about what you see as possible pre-mission issues that set up problematic events?
Yeah. You know, and this really, I think probably some of the biggest risk factors are just how missions are sold in general as being this absolutely wonderful 2 years. And there's some, you know, curbing of that every now and again. You have a leader, whether it be a bishop or a general authority, talk about how, you know, maybe it wasn't the best 2 years, but it's so valuable. But it's like it sets up this wave of excitement that then demands a certain level of buy-in and an absolute commitment. And you can't, and I guess this is kind of the nature of the fact that, you know, you're committing to 18 months to 2 years of your life. But you can't really halfway commit to serve a mission. And so if you decide to go, it's like, you know, these young men and women have to be just all in and so excited. And it really sets up this mindset, that I think becomes actually very vulnerable in a way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Continue with that thought.
Well, I just, you know, so among those lines as well comes, you know, extreme idealization and devaluation. This extreme idealization of the church and, you know, the prophets and the gospel and this kind of whitewashed perspective that, yes, you can believe the church is true, but I mean, it's, you know, these young men and women who maybe don't have these very substantive experiences in their lives, maybe they did, that connected them to, you know, spiritually to God. And so in lieu of that is this kind of hype. And then on the flip side of that, you know, you comes this great devaluation of the world and the worldly and all these, you know, heathens that you're going out to save, or people that are lost. And it really, right out of the gate, before you even go on your mission, kind of sets people up for a lot of black and white thinking and kind of rigid programmed answers to things that should require a lot of thought and consideration and empathy. Because at the end of the day, they're going out to serve and help and be with people. But I think missions are sold not as that, but instead as, you know, this, you're going to bring this great torch to everybody and save them. So that would kind of be my pre-mission trauma setup is that there may be pre-traumatizing experiences, but more than anything, it's like sets these ideals, this bar so high within the mind of the youth who are going, that it's almost doomed. It's almost doomed from the start in many ways.
Any further thoughts on that, Holly?
I would agree overall with what he said, though. My experience was somewhat different, in that one of the things that made me decide to go on a mission was spending 6 months, doing study abroad in the UK and then backpacking across Europe. And, I had an experience. I missed a train. I got on the wrong train in Italy. I got stuck in a train station. I had this very clear witness from the spirit, A, that I was in great danger, and B, that I was being protected, that made a very deep impression on me. I also walked into church my very first Sunday in London, sat down in Relief Society, and then grinned in amusement as the woman next to me did this double take because she had been my family home evening group leader at the University of Arizona. I knew she was on her mission in London, but she had no idea that I was going to be there. Anyway, her mission president was an old friend of my mother's, and Mormon connections being what they are, I spent a week with her doing missionary work. And so I had a fairly clear sense of what I was signing up for. And for a little Mormon girl from a horrible Mormon hick town, I was reasonably cosmopolitan. And so the discourse that Daniel was just talking about, even before my mission, really bugged me when people would tell me, oh, you're going to go convert all these people. It's like, well, that's not really what I want to do. And I naively imagined that I could do what I wanted to do as a missionary. I will also add that one of the things that I really, that was very upsetting, was going in for my physical and my non-member doctor just being outraged that he was supposed to test me for syphilis. That really upset him, that the church would want nice, pure young women to be tested for syphilis in order to go be missionaries. It was just a strange little detail, but it was upsetting in part because he was so upset by it.
That's interesting. I'm not familiar with all of the medical requirements necessarily that are part of the pre-mission, you know, kind of health checkups. Is that something that either one of you want to talk more about, or?
I reported to the MTC in June of 1985. I would imagine things have changed quite a bit since I went. I have no idea at this point.
You know, I can speak a little bit to my own experience, which, I served in Jamaica at about the turn of the millennium. And, you know, a standard physical, and I don't think I understood most of what was being asked or required. But one thing that seems kind of newer, that one of my brother-in-law had to go through is a more intensive mental health screening, followed by, you know, if I guess you are deemed as questionably fit mentally, that, you know, you can pursue some preventative or early mental health counseling to try and help curb maybe your anxiety or depression that may have already been there. But as for me, I was clueless. I was just like, okay, yeah, I'll go to the doctor and have him fill out these papers, and sure, I'll go to the dentist and have him look at my teeth. And I just was too excited to get going to really care or question myself.
Okay. And Holly, going back to something you said, you know, that you weren't really signing up to go convince other people, that your way was the right way. What were you signing up for? What was your hope of what you were signing up for?
Well, as an undergrad, I was a tour guide and recruiter for the University of Arizona. And that was very easy for me. I loved my undergraduate education. I love the U of A. It's where my parents met. My grandfather went there. It was so easy for me to tell people, I've had a great experience here. You can get a really good education. Aren't the buildings pretty? Don't you like the landscaping? But nobody's eternal salvation was on the line if somebody said, you know what, I'd really rather go to ASU, Arizona State. It hurt me. It harmed me to have to tell people, as I ended up having to do, you know, if you don't join this church, you can't live with God. In my heart, I did not really believe that. I could not believe that. So, you know, I mean, maybe I should not, I probably just should not have gone. There were many things about the church that I valued and I wanted to share. But I did not want, I found it coercive and harmful to tell people, you know what, you really need to join my church. I was much happier saying, here's an option you might enjoy. What do you think? And that, your companions just will not be okay with it if you approach missionary work that way.
Very true.
Do you feel, I was going to say, Daniel, do you feel like that's a case-by-case mission experience, or is that more across the board? Like, was that your experience as well, that it was kind of, you mentioned black and white thinking, like this is the only way to present the gospel, and we have to be very clear that this is the one and only way, or could it be more open to discussion or possibilities or even respect for the religions and cultures that you were finding yourselves in?
I think initially kind of mirroring what Holly said about how, you know, you're most of the time your companion, even if you did buy in that way, that it was more of a discussion and let's share. It was pretty rare to get a companion who, you know, thought the same thing. And so there's a lot of groupthink that would end up happening. And if you didn't conform to that, then you either kept to yourself or were kind of deemed as a bit of a missionary heretic. That said, I can speak to my own experience. I was so bright-eyed and bushy-tailed about the gospel and my own personal conversion that happened just, 4 years prior that I don't think I spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, if you don't accept this truth, then you're damned. I was too busy just wanting to share it. And then I was baffled. I was flabbergasted when people didn't want to hop on the bandwagon. And so for me, I kind of just had a denial of that grim side of preaching a one true church doctrine is that essentially by saying we're the only way, that means you're doomed if you don't come with us. Go ahead, Holly.
Well, but even if you don't, because I'm pretty sure we can play it back and I can listen. I'm pretty sure I didn't use the word damned. Maybe I did.
No, that was my word. You're totally right.
But even still, like, you know, the MTC, I went to Taiwan and I'm not a big lover of Asia. I wanted to go. I minored in France, in French. I wanted to go to France. But even still, I knew enough about Buddhism to know that it's not just some little, sect. And we would have these lessons in the MTC about it, where we were just encouraged to feel the contempt, that's really the only word for it. The contempt that was conveyed to us for the belief system of the people we were going out to teach. I just thought, how can this work?
Yeah.
We were never encouraged. I will tell you one thing. In some ways I was really lucky in my mission in that I had really exceptional mission presidents. And my second mission president, you know what? We're getting ahead of things. We probably should calm down.
That's okay. I mean, I don't mind you kind of just letting your thoughts go, and I'll bring it back to where I want it to come.
All right. Well, so all right, I'll try to pick that back up. So I was lucky in that I had really terrific mission presidents. They changed about a year into my mission, and the second one taught Asian language and Asian religion at a university owned by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I won't say which university, but, you can let your imagination run wild through all the various options. And at one point, because my mission was so difficult, I got permission to do a few things that were unusual. For instance, I was allowed to read whatever I wanted on P-Day, including novels, anything at all. And one day I was in a bookstore and I picked up this very slim paperback on Buddhism and took it home and read it. And, this is when I'd been out on my mission for well over a year, and I will mention this to non-members and they will be aghast that I would spend a year trying to convert someone without first learning anything in depth about what they believe. And whereas Mormons are shocked that I would bother. Why would you learn about Buddhism? It's false. It's what you're trying to teach people to leave. And when I went and talked to my mission president about it, this is what I told him. Because there were plenty of things I didn't understand. So I went to my mission president and I was like, explain this to me. And here's what he said. He said, I love Buddhism, Sister Welker. I'd be a Buddhist if it weren't for the fact that they reject the notion of the soul. How often do you hear a mission president say that he would rather be Buddhist than Mormon?
Yeah, there's something, I mean, one of my favorite classes at BYU was the intersection of world religions classes. And just, you know, there was a lot of respect in that class for all the different traditions and religious, you know, beliefs. And kind of, you know, we focused a little bit on how they differed, but also so many similarities, right? Which was really beautiful for me. So I tend to agree with you. It's nice to learn about where other people are coming from. Okay, so backing up to kind of this pre-mission setup that we've been discussing, we discussed expectations, kind of this, you know, we build it up. These are going to be the best few years of your life. You know, this is going to be such a great experience. You're going to love it. Without really maybe talking a little bit more about some of the realities or some of the things that could be expected, to happen. And so I think sometimes, you know, young missionaries go into this experience unprepared for the realities of their emotional state or psychological state, or just even the hardships that come with a totally different routine, being away from family, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Let's talk a little bit about even the process of getting to a mission. I think that there's a lot of potential here for trauma in the sense of there are worthiness interviews. There's been a big focus on setting the bar higher, meaning higher expectations on how you live your life and what type of decisions you've made as an adolescent. Many of those having to do with sexuality. But even like you were mentioning, you know, this mental health screening, which I think it, you know, in some ways is very helpful because, I think the acknowledgement that there are mental health conditions that can definitely affect a person's readiness or ability to serve in, you know, in different areas or even physical ailments that can affect people. At the same time, I know that that's been very limiting for some people who've desperately wanted to go on a mission and now could not, due to some of the results of those mental screenings. So again, there's a lot of different scenarios that either people are lying to make it past those types of screenings, or and then that sets them up for failure because now there's already guilt and shame from the get-go, especially since you're going through the temple as a young missionary, right? And there's a lot of rhetoric in there as far as, you know, the Lord will not be mocked and, you know, you better be here with all integrity and honesty. And if you've lied in some type of mission interview because you didn't want to let your bishop know that you were masturbating in the last month because that would stop you from going and you didn't want to be embarrassed in front of your entire family system. Right. Or you just, you know, you had sex with your girlfriend unintentionally because, you know, you were both sad at leaving each other. I mean, all those kinds of scenarios, right? That can happen for either gender. So this is kind of, it's a very high bar at a very young age where we now know that impulsivity and rebellion and not really quite knowing who you are yet are normal parts of teenage development. Right. And yet during that time, we're expecting, strict obedience, kind of rigid expectations. And I'd just like to hear a little bit of your thoughts about the potential kind of messes that happen with this setup.
Yeah. Well, you know, even mirroring exactly what you said, this bar for perfection combined with the social pressures of, you know, of course you're going to go on a mission, but then, you know, you end up getting
especially
delayed.
For men, right? I mean, yeah. Men have a higher, I guess, pressure to go. Women are obviously more able to go, but it's not as... It's not seen as awful if they don't.
Well, for women, you get the question, you get a lot of people, it's probably better now, but there were many people who tried to dissuade me. I had to promise my bishop that if someone asked me to marry him between when I started the process and actually left, that I would accept his proposal and not go on a mission. I had a lot of people saying, but you're reasonably attractive. Why are you going on a mission? What's wrong with you that you're going on a mission? That was, you know. And I also had one of my favorite professors when I told him I was going on a mission He said, "Oh, you're religious? That's so disappointing. You seem so smart."
Oh, man.
I mean, the main thing I would say is it takes great resolve.
Yeah.
Even if that resolve is simply to go along with the process.
Right.
Yeah. You know,
I was just going, that resolve can often be enough to get you through the any trauma, because there is this thing to look forward to. You have this big thing, the looming expectation, the excitement of actually going, I think, probably serves to minimize pre-mission trauma. And where the trauma really sets in is the MTC.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I think in my assessment, it really is more of, it's like the worthiness interviews and so forth. It's more of this building a taller and taller glass tower that's ready to be shattered in the MTC. And then whatever is not decimated in the MTC has a potential to become such in the mission field when your mission turns out to be nothing like you thought it would be. But there's certainly, even in the best of circumstances, right, where a young man or woman is worthy and they're good to go, but there still is all this pressure, just the sheer realization of, you know, if for some reason this priesthood holder who I hold in such high regard that maybe I think that they know me better than I know myself, that if they find something just slightly amiss, then this huge dream is going to be, you know, a dream deferred or crushed or delayed. And so it just kind of tightens those, you know, piano strings all the more. And there may be, and I'm sure I just don't talk to them in my practice, missionaries who just kind of laissez-faire their way through it, and they are the more resilient type of missionaries that kind of just roll with things. But that's not who we're here talking about.
Right. Well, that's kind of what's tragic, is that oftentimes the kids who take the religion most seriously are set up for the most damage.
Yes. In my assessment, I think that really the two populations of adolescents that are most at risk of being damaged by their missionary experience would be those who buy in the most to the religion and to the mission process. You know, they go out there primed and ready to change the whole world, or those who go into it with a story similar to Holly's, where they have sort of this desire to share something meaningful to them, but at the same time, they know that they don't fit this mold that they're trying to be crammed into. And so it creates just repeated, frustrating encounters and almost like an unspoken battle fatigue, so to speak. Would you agree, Holly?
Yes. And battle fatigue is a nice term. Actually, one of my subspecialties within my degree is combat memoir, because it's the genre of literature I found that most closely resembles what my mission was like.
Oh, wow.
Well, and that brings up an interesting point, because when we're talking about trauma, I mean, we're serious. I mean, this is many, I think, Daniel, you would agree with me, but as a practitioner, when you go down the criteria of PTSD, many of these things fit. So oftentimes we think of PTSD as a soldier's problem, you know, like in war, but traumatic events can happen in a variety of settings for a variety of reasons. And and it really is a traumatic experience that people are trying to recover from.
And sort of a misnomer of it is this idea that the trauma has to be this event, this singular occurrence that happens, you know, quickly, a plane explodes or a gunfight breaks out. When especially referring to this mission trauma that we're discussing, it really is a lot about the sheer time involved and the length and the depth of exposure. The fact that you're not just undergoing all of this pressure and all of these psychological demands for a day or a week or even a month or even 6 months, but you're there for, at that point, you know, significant percentage of your life so far. And so it really has time to marinate and soak in and throw things into disarray.
That is absolutely true, but I would also add that if there is an event, and in my case there was, it's such a silly thing, but I fell through my neighbor's kitchen roof. It's a long story. I dropped a letter. I fell through my neighbor's kitchen roof. I broke my rib. I got a concussion. And it messed everything up. And I felt very foolish. I wanted to retrieve this letter that I had dropped off my back balcony, and I walked out to get it and just crashed through the roof and did all this damage to my poor neighbor's kitchen. And even at the time, still had the presence of mind to joke about how glad I was that she wasn't cooking dinner. What if I had landed in the walk and gotten third degree burns all over my legs in addition to broken bones? But this was back before anybody knew that an unhealed concussion was a thing. And I had vertigo. I would wake up in some mornings in a bed that rolled and heaved, and I would vomit from motion sickness before I even got out of bed. I cried for 9 weeks. I walked around my mission handing out pamphlets to people with tears streaming down my face, and you can imagine how effective I was. You know, hey, do you want to learn more about my church? It makes people really happy. That's why I'm, you know, just crying.
Yeah.
So there was this event, and you know, one of the questions that, you know, Natasha, you asked us what did we want to talk about? I want to talk about how illness and injury can be part of trauma, and that was traumatic in and of itself. But the fact that I was 9,000 miles away from home, that I had so few resources, that, you know, I was in a really remote area. I had one companion. There were so few resources available to help me. And I had been a pretty strong person before that. And part of the trauma of my mission was simply seeing was seeing myself disintegrate.
Mm. Yeah. You know, and among those lines, Holly, I really conceptualize mission related trauma to follow the idea. I don't know if anybody out there heard of vicarious trauma, which is a concept developed by Perlman and Sequitney to addressing basically the cumulative and transforming effects that psychotherapists receive or go through as they hear story after story after story of trauma and traumatic events. And exactly one of the things that is discussed and identified in that is this dissolution or this dissolving of yourself as you used to see yourself and as you used to understand yourself. And that, I think, is a major component of mission-related trauma, is that the self is so impacted and altered without our permission. And we end up seeing, you know, missionaries end up seeing parts of themselves go away that they quite liked.
I really mourned the death of my imagination. Mm-hmm. It was very, I was a poet. I majored in creative writing as an undergrad. And yes, realizing that I had absolutely no imagination, that I was about as creative as a plate of cold fried rice. It was devastating.
Meaning that this head trauma that you experienced had that effect on your thinking? Or just how you perceived yourself?
It's all just such a crapshoot. I loved my MTC companion. I loved my trainer. I loved my second companion. My third companion and I hated each other. Mm. And she really got under my skin and told me I was a bad person, and I believed her in many ways, and it was after her, I transferred to a new area, and it was after that that I had this injury, and it just was this really weird marinade where, actually, I said that thing about, like, I can't, the thing about I have no imagination, that was a complaint before I had the accident. That was already, I had already seen myself cease to be the person I cared about. Mm-hmm. And then I had the injury. So.
Which really just compounds, I would imagine it really just compounded and multiplied the feelings of kind of, you know, powerlessness that you already had kind of pervading your daily life.
Yeah.
So just to backtrack, so trauma, we're saying, can often happen with obviously an event like you're describing, Holly, but also like you were mentioning, Daniel, it can be kind of a chronic tension or ongoing experience. For example, many people who grew up in abusive homes, there's not necessarily one event that stands out, but there's this chronic tension that they're having to negotiate, you know, on a regular basis that includes adrenaline release and all that, that really isn't supposed to be happening on a regular basis. And so those kinds of defense mechanisms and coping mechanisms are triggered in ways that normally wouldn't be there on, you know, on a daily basis.
Yeah.
And back to your, you know, illness and health issues. I mean, let's talk about that a little bit, because that was a big emphasis on my interview with the founders of SickRMs. Let's talk a little bit about how that sets up when so much of, I think, missionary jargon has to do with the more righteous and obedient you are, the more blessed you will be, the more success you will have. So those two are very correlated and very equated to one another. And therefore, when you have something happen, like an accident or a health concern come up, or even mental health issues, like you're finding yourself depressed or things of that nature, it's very easy for the missionary to self-blame and become the victim in that scenario of how it's set up to begin with.
Yeah. You know, I've got a good friend who really experienced this in his mission, and it's kind of unreal. He was telling me he had one mission president for his home mission, who I think was a dangerous man. But basically in his mission, they had what they called the sick house. And if you got sick, you had to decide if it was bad enough to report to the mission president's wife. And the reason that you had to decide if that was worth it is because if you did, then the protocol was that you go to the sick house. You were sentenced there for a number of days. You weren't allowed to leave. My buddy mentioned that usually the first time is 7 days, and that while there, you and your companion had nothing to do except for sit in the room with your scriptures and look at each other. And the mission president actively reinforced this idea that, you know, the reason that they're sick is because they don't have the faith to be healed and keep carrying forth the Lord's work. And it's dangerous. It's a dangerous but very,
well, it's abusive.
Yeah,
it is.
Mm-hmm. And a very easy mindset to fall into, especially by these, you know, young minds who might not yet have the ego strength to just say, you know what, that's crazy. I feel like crap because I feel like crap. It has nothing to do with my worthiness. And so there's a lot of buy into this. Abuse.
You also get it from, you get it from your companions. This is a story. I'll call this person, she was my companion. I'll call her Sister Smith. Sister Smith, before I met her, had a companion, Sister Young, who was a registered nurse. She was a welfare services sister for our mission. And Sister Smith sprained her ankle very, very badly. could not walk. Sister Young, again, a registered nurse, let her go home for a couple of hours and rest. And then when it got to be evening, she said, okay, come on, we're going out. And Sister Smith just looked at her and she said, you're a nurse. And Sister Young blushed because she knew she had no business telling somebody with a very badly sprained ankle to go ride a bike and walk around. But she was also really angry that she had to stay home and that her hours were going to be bad. And that was a constant thing missionaries complaining. Oh, my companion, they're like, they always get these headaches and so we can never work and our hours suck. And district leaders saying, oh man, such and such a companionship. They just bring our district numbers down and you get it from everyone. You get it from everyone. And, one of the things I sent you as a, you know, part of preparation and discussion was a flyer from my mission for a zone conference where we were told to rethink our sleep. You sleep too much. I never knew a missionary who got enough sleep. And they were telling us to sleep even less. So everything, all the rhetoric on your mission is to encourage you to neglect your body. And I collected, I mean, it's not just my own story that I can draw on in discussing this. I wanted to write an article about this, and I solicited stories from people about mission trauma. There was one woman who went to, I believe it was Iceland, and her mission president wanted the missionaries to work 70 hours every week, which is abnormal. In order to meet these hours, most of the missionaries didn't eat. They would skip dinner. And finally, a general authority came and said, what is wrong with all the missionaries in your mission? Why do they look like crap? An edict had to be issued that missionaries could not work over a certain amount of, yeah. I mean, there is craziness.
Yeah. A lot of very intensive buy-in, like you said, Holly, from all around. I mean, I myself had the pleasure of not one but two kidney stones simultaneously in Jamaica that were large enough that the physician who was finally able to locate them said, you know, if you were in the States, we just hit these with a laser, but we don't have that laser here, so you're going to have to pass them. And it was brutal, and I just had a companion who, you know, he could not contain himself to hang out while I underwent the wonderful process of trying to pass stones. And so here I am, literally limping along, hunched over, doing missionary work. And, you know, there was a little bit of a give and take in that we'd come in a little bit earlier and we'd take a little bit of longer lunch and we'd leave a little bit later in the day. But, you know, passing stones while tracting is not something that I would recommend. But we didn't even have like an overt conflict, or my companion didn't reinforce this idea that I wasn't righteous enough to be healed. It was just, I was serving with someone who had a work ethic that, and a zeal that just wouldn't be stopped by my health needs.
Yep. Yeah.
Go ahead.
You are not allowed to be a human being with a body. The rhetoric of the church about the importance of bodies to me is utterly contradicted by the expectations of a mission where you are just simply supposed to deny the needs of your body. They aren't real. Your physical self does not really even exist. You can vanquish it just by thinking hard enough.
Yeah.
It just seems how the whole structure, and we'll talk about structure here in a minute, but
the structure of a mission rewards over-scrupulous behavior. Mm-hmm. And so the more almost fanatic you are or exaggerated you are in your efforts, that seems like very righteous. And oftentimes I think those are the people that even get promoted into leadership positions. My experience talking to many, many people about mission presidents is that there seems to be a wide spectrum of those who seem to fit that bill, you know, versus others that are much more relaxed and easygoing and, you know, able to kind of calm everybody's anxieties. But, you know, I'm gonna read from a memo from a mission president right now that just happened in May in California. And he states in his kind of newsletter to his missionaries, live exactly obedient that the Lord will be able to bless you as well as be willing to bless you. So completely, you know, I'm just kind of traumatized just reading that because it poses the relationship with divinity, first of all, as something that's earned and not just freely given, which goes against everything that the atonement and grace is about in our own doctrine. And this thought that the Lord would be willing to bless you. In other words, you know, the Lord kind of has to think about it. And it's deemed on your exact obedience. I mean, those are very purposeful and words that leave little wiggle room for anything. How do you measure, for example, exact obedience? How do you know that you haven't, like you said, slept 5 minutes too long or read one scripture too little or not knocked on one more door or, you know, I mean, that type of exactness can be so paralyzing and I think just an unattainable expectation that continually makes you face failure on a regular basis. And everything that happens wrong to you, because things will happen wrong, will then be through that lens of I'm not being blessed or the Lord is not willing to bless me. And I can think, I'm sure, of something I wasn't exactly obedient to. Now, it's not very hard. It can be just a bad thought, right, in our culture.
Yeah. It really does add insult to injury that not only are you experiencing, you know, a failure of expectation. I don't know any missionary that went out into the field thinking, I'd be fine if I didn't baptize anybody. But in addition to that, then you get to internalize that perceived failure and state that it happened because of your shortcomings. And so it really is a wicked 1-2 punch. And I like that you highlighted, Natasha, that it really does a disservice to or is contrary to the atonement and to the whole idea that, you know, we are flawed and imperfect beings who nonetheless are worthwhile and worthy of God's grace. But you can't acknowledge that and create the kind of social control or motivation that a mission president might feel is needed to get the numbers up. and so acceptance of reality and compassion for the self and compassion for one another and the best efforts that are being put forward really get to be pushed aside. And it really is this, you know, this mentality that it's easier to think, well, if I just did something different, even if I have to swallow this negative internalization, that at least I still have control over the situation. So this sacrificing of reality and of the value of the self for the service of attaining a goal.
And I actually remember very consciously at one point deciding I will, in order to survive, I will cease trying to make sense of my world.
Wow.
I'd been out, about a year and and the other thing is I was especially in the sick RNs. That's a really interesting project, and I am so glad they are doing that work. But, you know, it never once occurred to me to go home. I knew within 10 minutes of saying goodbye to my parents that I was not going to like the MTC. And it never once occurred to me to go home any more than it occurred to me to, I don't know, get the CTR emblem tattooed on my forehead. I mean, it's, I never, ever thought I would go home. And I was bound and determined to stay. And that, I think, is another thing, this emphasis on enduring to the end. I did not need any training in enduring to the end. I needed training in the fine art of judicious giving up. And the other thing is, like, even though I was really badly depressed, it never even occurred to me to stay in bed. I got up every day, partly because I had horrible insomnia. I went out every single day. Even, like I said, even with tears streaming down my face, I would still go do the work. And I remember talking to my second mission president once about the things I was facing. And he was an interesting guy. I mean, even in the 80s, he was advocating for women to get the priesthood, and he would complain to me about elders. He said that they had a lot of directionless enthusiasm, and you could just channel it into a project and they would get a lot done, but it didn't mean they understood what they were doing. And I said, well, you know, imagine having those guys run your life. And he said, yeah, that's annoying. He said, but think about this. You have some goofy 20-year-old chastising you. He said, but if things aren't going well for me, I get a call from Salt Lake. And it had never before occurred to me that mission presidents actually were, because Daniel just mentioned this, that mission presidents actually are under pressure to baptize.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, you know, my mission president was given the edict that if he couldn't turn the mission around, that they were going to close it. The Jamaica Kingston Mission had some pretty rough times. And granted, I'll own up to this being somewhat hearsay. I didn't hear this directly from the mission president's mouth, but I heard it from some APs who, you know, spent a lot of time with my mission president. And there were a lot of horror stories of how dysfunctional and I'll just use the term sinful that the mission ran for a while. And so, yeah, my mission president was basically told if you can't turn it around and get it functioning, then we're going to close the doors. And I remember just thinking that I couldn't imagine how much pressure that would be.
Mm-hmm. Do you guys know about the baseball baptisms in the UK in the 60s?
I do not.
I've heard about them in South America.
Well, yeah, it's a situation where missionaries were under such pressure to baptize that they would offer to teach little British boys to play baseball, and then they would take them swimming, and they would count that as a baptism.
Oh, wow.
And often the kids didn't even know they'd been baptized until somebody called and asked them why they weren't coming to church. And I'm going to read a little something. This is a guy who was there. He wrote a piece in Sunstone. It was in Sunstone in the 1996. Richard Maven, The Woodbury Years, An Insider's Look at Baseball Baptisms in Britain. Nearly every Monday morning, supervising elders from the districts journeyed to Exhibition Road near Hyde Park in London to sit through some of the best orchestrated sales meetings I have ever seen conducted. I can honestly say that even in my marketing career, I have never been subjected to the kind of intense pressure that I experienced at those meetings. Charts, graphs, and promotional materials were well prepared and deftly implemented by Mission President T. Bowring Woodbury and his staff. The highlight of the meeting was the pledging of baptisms for the coming week. So yes, there's just an inordinate amount of pressure. And just since we've been saying all these unflattering, difficult things, I will say that this is one reason I was simply overjoyed when I heard that the church is making the move in many missions to more service, to having missionaries spend the bulk of their time in service, just helping people instead of this really difficult enterprise of trying to track down strangers who might want to talk to you. It's very hard, and it is a great deal of pressure.
Yeah, I'll give a hallelujah to that. And note that while I was on my mission, Jamaica was hit by a pretty intense hurricane, and we shut down proselyting for several months. And that was really the most smooth and fulfilling two to three months of my mission, was just getting to serve people. And as I agree with Holly, I think it's a great move by the church, and will do wonders for, I think, real conversion, and will also do wonders for the missionaries who are serving, I believe.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Mental Health. To discuss this episode, please check us out at mormonmentalhealth.org. To keep the podcast alive, please consider a donation today, again, at mormonmentalhealth.org. Logo was provided by Daniel Singer. Music was generously donated by Lower Lights. Please check them out at thelowerlights.com. And thanks for listening.
Over last tempestuous sea, charred and compass came from thee. Jesus, Savior, pilot me. Unknown ways before me roll, hiding rock and treacherous shore, charred and compass came from thee. Jesus, Savior, pilot me.
Twixt me and
twixt me.
peaceful rest.
The peaceful rest.
Then while leaning on my breast, may I hear.